Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
Brewing is a beer thing, but cider and mead are kind of like wine, so you're really like a winemaker.
We talk mead today. James Robinson and Drew Schrader were a couple of failed homebrewers when they discovered mead making. Our demand for meat in America began growing exponentially after World War II, and that's one of the reasons so many Midwest farms grow so much corn. Also from Harvest Public Media, how soccer is bridging the cultural divide in a Colorado meatpacking town. For a snack today, it's pancakes from Daniel Orr's kitchen. He had something special to make them green. And then a trip to the woods, far away from any appliances or electrical outlets, for an old-fashioned cooking competition. News stories with Mark Chilla from around the food world.
In a surprise move, some U.S. Senate Democrats have joined Republicans in support of a bill that requires labeling food that has genetically modified ingredients. But as Harvest Public Media's Peggy Lowe reports, Congress thinks there's a communication problem.
Even as members of the Senate Ag Committee appeared to support the idea of labeling GMO foods, they spent much of a committee hearing yesterday saying they were frustrated. North Dakota Democrat Heidi Heitkamp interrupted a USDA scientist who was trying to explain the science behind genetically altered food.
Except what people hear is blah, 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 blah.
I know that.
I think that's a serious problem because we're talking about how do we provide consumer information consumers want versus what consumers need.
The ranking Democrat, Senator Debbie Stabenow, says she's committed to getting a GMO labeling bill passed by the end of the year. The House passed a bill in July that outlaws state labeling laws and would set up a voluntary federal system. Peggy Lowe, Harvest Public Media.
By the end of 2016, Yum brands in China will be no more. Say hello to Yum China. After several scandals damaged the fast food juggernaut, Yum Brands has struggled to rebuild its reputation in a country formerly in love with its products. Yum brand KFC had no sooner attempted to clean up controversy over excessive antibiotics in their Chinese restaurants when an undercover video showed meat suppliers mishandling chicken destined for KFC restaurants. Yum decided to split after investor and CEO of hedge fund Corvex Management, Keith Meister, joined the board in May. The split will result in two publicly traded separate companies. Yum China will pay franchise rights to Yum Brands for use of KFC, Pizza Hut, and Taco Bell, which isn't in China yet. More than half of food workers go into work even when sick, a new survey found. Alchemy polled 1,200 food workers across the United States and Canada and found 51% responded they always or frequently go into work while sick. Most food workers, 79% according to 2012 data, don't have paid sick leave. One of the lowest paying jobs is food service, where many simply can't afford to take an unpaid day. And an Alaskan company has been courting California with a plan to ship up to 9 billion gallons of water from a lake near Sitka. State lawmaker Janice Hahn is taking the idea seriously, calling it an idea worth exploring. She met with executives with Alaska Bulk Water in September to talk over details. Water shipped in tankers would cost the state about 6 cents per gallon, which is 12 times the rate California currently pays for its water. The state would also have to upgrade infrastructure to offload and store the water, Hahn told the USA Today. She said, quote, "It seems a little expensive at this point," unquote. As always, you can learn more about these stories at eartheats.org. Then add your 2 cents to the conversation happenings on Twitter, at EarthEats.
Mark, stick with us for your story about some mead makers coming up in a few.
Thanks. I'll be here.
Farmers planted close to 90 million acres of corn this season. A lot of that gigantic crop will go to fatten up the livestock that becomes hamburgers, chicken fillets, and pork chops. In part two of Harvest Public Media's series Choice Cuts, Meat in America, Abby Wendell reports on how the world's appetite for meat has shaped the Corn Belt.
Roger Kelso is behind the wheel of a big red combine. All day, he's been harvesting stalks of brittle corn. But he hasn't broken a sweat.
They give me the easy jobs. I'm 82, so I get to pick what I want.
Kelso helps his two sons farm nearly 4,000 acres of corn and soybeans in western Illinois. The majority of it will go to feed livestock. Driving around the Midwest, you'll see plenty of farms like the Kelsos. Field after field of corn and soybeans, tall silver grain bins, and white barns. What you typically don't see? Cows or chickens or hogs. But when Kelso was a kid, the farms around here raised the animals too.
Everybody around here fed cattle and hogs, and my dad fed about 200 head of cattle every year, and he'd probably have 600 head of hogs a year, and the neighbors across the road there probably had fed out 400 head of cattle.
That began to change in the 1950s, when diversified farms like the one Kelso grew up on started breaking into specialized chunks. Chickens migrated southeast, cattle were herded southwest, other types of animal feed like oats and hay moved north and west. Corn stayed put.
Today we're much more concentrated here in the upper Midwest as far as that corn production is concerned.
Chad Hart is an economist at Iowa State University. He says farms begin to specialize in growing either animals or their feed in service to efficiency.
We figured out the assembly line definitely has some advantages. They could lower their cost structure. They could improve their production patterns when they concentrated on fewer enterprises.
The corn assembly line is wildly productive. Farmers will harvest an estimated 13.5 billion bushels this year. Iowa, Illinois, and Nebraska grow almost half of that. A fraction of it goes to sweeten things we eat and drink. About a third is made into ethanol for fuel. And when you figure in exports and byproducts, more than half feeds livestock. So that plentiful, cheap corn from the Midwest, it helps feed the world's appetite for meat. To get the corn out of the Midwest and to the animals, the first stop is a place like this, Western Grain Marketing. Part grain elevator, part train station. A few times a month, a locomotive jumps onto a track that loops around WGM's giant grain bins. The train lurches forward every few minutes, filling each car with a waterfall of corn. Once loaded, it chugs down to cattle feedlots and ethanol plants in Texas and Mexico.
We're bringing stuff in, shipping it out constantly.
Scott Sims is a manager here. He says recently the trains have also been hauling their corn to Pilgrim's Pride chicken houses.
They go through one shuttle, which is 450,000 bushel in 6 days. That's a lot of corn for chickens.
How many chickens?
We tried to figure that out one time, and we finally got into the millions and give up. It's a lot.
While chickens and cattle are largely raised elsewhere, a lot of hogs are raised in the Midwest, close to their feed. They don't take up lots of valuable space. They're often inside climate-controlled concrete barns, built to house tens of thousands of hogs at a time. That's why farmers like the Kelsos brought hogs back.
The old saying goes, swap the hogs. This is truly swapping the hogs because it makes a kind of a moist, soft feed for them. They can eat it better and digest it better.
Clark Kelso, one of Roger's sons, is in their hog barn, watering down feed for hundreds of identical pink piglets.
They're really playful, especially when they're little. Some days you come in here and they're running laps.
The Kelsos fatten up the hogs for a company that owns the piglets. In exchange, they get cash and the hog manure to spread on their fields, which helps them grow more grain, to feed more livestock, to ultimately produce more meat. Abby Wendell, Harvest Public Media.
The next installment in Choice Cuts comes next week about curbing antibiotic use in livestock. Their website is harvestpublicmedia.org. It turned out to be a good thing that two of the founders of Oddball Fermentables were terrible at making beer. They switched their DIY energies from beer to a less common homemade beverage, mead. As Mark Chilla finds out, part of the challenge of crafting a delicious glass of mead is simply letting others know what in the world it is.
You're going to have so much recording of things being poured.
When you think about mead, if you think about anything at all, you might be picturing a very ancient drink.
Mead carries with it a lot of connotations of Vikings and hobbits.
That's James Robinson, co-founder of Oddball Fermentables, an up-and-coming meadery from Bloomington, Indiana. The honey-fermented alcoholic beverage is as old as recorded history itself, mentioned in ancient tomes like Beowulf and the Canterbury Tales.
We also think it's a pretty modern drink, you know, even though it's got a lot of ancient echoes, so to speak.
As the guys from Oddball Fermentables bring mead into the modern world, they have to fight against other mead stereotypes as well. For instance, mead is sometimes known for being cloyingly sweet. It's made from honey, after all.
Nothing wrong with sweetness, but we tend to like it to be drier.
Robinson's palate for a drier beverage comes from his love of beer. He tried his hand at homebrewing years ago, in fact, but never quite got the hang of it.
I mean, I remember back in the early 90s, we would make beer, you know, my friends and I, we'd make beer, and we'd try to make the beer that we liked, and, you know, I was never able to brew anything that really knocked my socks off.
Having tried unsuccessfully to brew his own beer, Robinson wanted a different challenge, and that's when he heard about cider, a kind of mead made with apple juice. I'll have Robinson explain.
So mead is sort of the parent beverage. You know, anytime you're making some kind of wine that's predominantly fermented from honey, it's called mead. And then underneath mead are a bunch of different variations. So if you use honey and grape juice, it's called piment. If you use honey and any general kind of fruit, it's called a melomel. And our version of melomel is actually called cider. So if you use honey and apple juice, it's called a cider.
Robinson was bit by the cider bug, and now he just needed a partner in crime. This was about 8 years ago, and Robinson was working at the time as a teacher at Bloomington South High School. It was there that he met a fellow teacher and fellow struggling homebrewer named Drew Schrader.
Everybody starts out making beer, and so, you know, I got my bucket and had it in the closet and tried making different things. But for me, my beer always tasted like homebrew.
Robinson and Schrader began experimenting with different kinds of sizers, adding ginger, berries, or dates to create new and unique flavors.
This is what we call first date. It's exactly what you think it is. It's a sizer made with dates. And then this is called hop berry red. It's red raspberries, hops, and sizer. Which one do you want to try?
Eventually, they took their hobby to the judges' table, winning awards at various competitions, including the Indy International Wine Competition.
So this is what we call cider punk. It's our ginger cinnamon. So again, it's the base of honey and apple juice. And in this case, we put about 2 or 3 ounces of ginger in a 5-gallon batch, along with 4, 5, 6 of cinnamon.
Oddball's dry cizers have a flavor that is completely unique in the world of alcoholic beverages.
The main thing you're tasting, which is what you're not expecting, is honey. Honey is not a common thing that people drink when it's fermented, and so a lot of that kind of earthy flavor there is really coming from the honey. This is clover honey. The tartness or the sourness is coming from the apple juice, and then the other part about cizers and meads is that even if they're dry, they're sort of deceptive because all that honey and juicy kind of stuff makes your brain think, oh, this is sweet, and then you're kind of waiting for that, but it never actually comes.
Now officially under the name Oddball Fermentables, because creating cider makes them oddballs in the alcohol world, they decided to scale up their operation to retail. Scaling up has meant acquiring a space for the tasting room, as well as obtaining licenses to make their honey wine. Yes, technically mead and cider are classified as wines. It's also meant finding the right local and sustainable ingredients. For honey, especially, that's become a particular challenge.
Honey is just a really expensive ingredient, and when you're thinking about fermentable sugars, honey is one of the more expensive ones. And so as we try to make something that is really delicious, but is also comes in at a price point that people feel is reasonable, we have to kind of balance that out. And so I think for us, the main thing is being able to find a honey that we feel good about.
Despite the challenges, the Oddball guys feel like they have one thing working in their favor in the commercial world once they open their tasting room. Cider is unique.
I think it's fun to play in a playground that's not completely overrun with other kids. It's not beer, it's not wine, it's just in this middle.
And the middle is where the Oddballs feel at ease. For Earth Eats, I'm Mark Chilla.
See a picture of the Oddballs at eartheats.org. Although we can't tell you how to make mead, we do love honey at Earth Eats. Our resident chef uses it as a topping on our recipe. Then,
you know, the number of coals is really important. You want to put very few below the Dutch oven.
We go inside the annual Dutch oven cook-off at Patoka Lake. production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington.
Secret ingredient. Hemp seeds.
That's Daniel Orr. I'm Annie Corrigan. The good chef is making pancakes for us this morning with three different hemp ingredients. The seeds, yes, and some powder and some hemp oil. Before we get to the recipe, let's make sure we're all on the same page. Yes, hemp is edible. And no, it will not get you high like its plant cousin, marijuana. We've heard stories from Harvest Public Media in the recent past about how some farmers consider hemp to be the next big thing in American ag, if only it wasn't so highly regulated. Right now, only 13 states allow farmers to grow hemp. Since Indiana is one of those states, Daniel was able to score his hemp products from a nearby farm. Here he is.
It's a very simple recipe. We're going to start with some banana as part of our liquid ingredient. Couple eggs in here. We've got a quarter cup of flour, and we got a pinch of salt, a pinch of sugar, and then we're going to add a quarter cup of the hemp protein powder.
What does this stuff taste like?
It's very, very mild. It doesn't taste like a dirty bong or anything like that. The seeds are also very, very neutral. They just add a little crunchiness and some texture. We're just going to mash all this together. We're not adding any dairy to this. So now we'll just go over to the stove and we'll start cooking these up. Now the oil, as you'll see, is a very clear, neutral colored oil.
This is hemp oil.
This is hemp oil. Put a nice big pancake in each pan. You could also make these into little silver dollar pancakes, but we're just all gonna split these big ones today. Brown them off on one side. Top them with those hemp seed kernels. And that's going to give us a nice little crunch once we flip them over.
Would you just eat these raw, just straight out of the bag?
Yeah, you can eat them right out of the bag, sprinkle them on salad, just kind of like you would wheat germ. You know, a lot of people, especially from my generation, used to, all of us hippies used to eat wheat germ. They're starting to get nice and brown. Now, these will be a little bit more tender than a regular pancake because there's not as much flour in them. There's no dairy in them.
Oh, right. Those are beautiful. They don't look green so much at all anymore. They're a nice dark brown.
All right, and there we go. Those are our hemp seed and banana pancakes with fresh berries and local honey. Bon appetit.
Dark brown on the outside, but when you slice into it, the pancakes are still a deep, dark green. The kids will love them. See the recipe and some pictures at eartheats.org. Meatpacking plants dot the Midwest and offer a decent paycheck to people without strong English skills. That means that the plants draw refugees and immigrants to towns that haven't hosted particularly diverse populations in the past. For Harvest Public Media, Ponce Rush brings us this story of students with many different backgrounds coming together.
Fort Morgan is a town in northeastern Colorado with a population of about 11,000.
And actually, our little town, it's an anomaly. We have all these people from other places in the world, and we have one thing in common, is soccer.
That's Nick Ng. He runs a cafe, teaches art, and coaches both the boys and girls soccer teams at Fort Morgan High School, the Mustangs.
But out of curiosity, even for myself, just shout out like your different countries that you're from. Even, you know, I know we got some Fort Morgan, just
Guatemala,
El Salvador,
Mexico,
Kenya,
Somalia,
Somalia. Africa. Which country? Not
country. Africa's a big
country.
Hey, this guy's Russian.
Ukraine. Sergey's Ukraine.
Many of the Mustangs have grown up here, but few call themselves Caucasian. People of Latino ancestry have lived in Fort Morgan for decades. And in 2006, a wave of refugees from Eastern Africa brought the population from 0% African American to somewhere between 6 and 10%. That kind of population change is common in meatpacking towns from Postville, Iowa, to Lexington, Nebraska, to Roseville, Illinois.
Where I come? Well, 'cause soccer's life.
James Lara and his best friend Eddie, or Heriberto Munoz, are both sophomores and identify as Hispanic. And waiting next to Eddie and James is Dwali Abdi.
I have a passion because I want to be professional, you know. And my dad used to play soccer, though.
Yeah.
No, he's not here, though. He's in Africa right now.
Abdi has lived in Fort Morgan for 3 years. Before that, he lived in Cleveland. And before that, Somalia. He sends his father photos of his soccer games.
He's saying like that. Keep doing, you know, what you're doing, you know.
Coach Ng says the makeup of his team gives them a scrappy dynamic when they're on the field. But it's also led to some unwanted tensions during games.
We all play some schools that don't have the diversity we have. And yes, things are said on the field.
Ng and his assistant coach, Juan Anguiano, have heard their share of slurs.
If the referee doesn't hear, it's totally legal. And all we do, hey, just keep it cool, it's part of the game, do the right thing.
They report the really hurtful incidents, but the truth is that those players are outside of their control. So they focus on what they can control, the cohesion of the Fort Morgan Mustangs. This isn't always easy.
What you might see is that when the kids arrive, they do sit separately.
There are a few clusters of Latino kids and a few clusters of African kids lacing up their cleats before practice. The Lone Rangers, like the kid from Ukraine, get absorbed into other groups. But otherwise, the team looks like how I remember my school cafeteria, with different cliques loosely based on ethnicity or neighborhood.
I need to incorporate some strategies to get them to mingle more.
Some of those strategies are a typical part of building a team. For example, if Coach Ng hears a swear word, he and all 50 or so guys at practice drop to the ground and start doing crunches.
Don't get comfortable. You always have to be trying 110%.
And they do a lot of crunches. James Lara says that by the end of last season, he had six-pack abs.
Over the summer, I got fat. So I only have like half of 4 packs.
And for every kid who's late, the whole team has to run a stride, meaning that they run to the half line and then sprint to the opposite goalpost.
All the way! Cross the line!
They run drills together, they pass to each other, and who knows which players will be waiting for you on the sidelines to join the scrimmage. Plus, it's only the beginning of the season, and Coach Ng says some of the team are still just learning each other's names.
What I do at the end of practice, we do hands around. So everyone's shaking hands, introducing themselves over and over again so that we get to know each other's names.
I'm ready.
Only when each of the players touches 3 other players' hands can they go home. And if they know everyone's name, they still have to touch hands and say, good game or nice play, something to show sportsmanship.
I do need to do whatever I can to break down some of those barriers. It's a comfort zone. It's a comfort zone.
Next, Coach Ng is thinking of getting the kids to draw a teammate's name out of a hat and eat lunch with that person all week. Sounds a bit like the movie Remember the Titans. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Ponce Rutch.
Harvest Public Media reports on farm and food issues in collaboration with public media stations across the Midwest. That story was originally produced for KUNC in Colorado. It's the perfect time of year to go hang out in the woods and do some old-fashioned outdoor cooking. Last year around this time, I spent the day at Patoka Lake in southern Indiana. Every year, they host the Dutch Oven Cook-Off, where amateur cooks are armed with nothing but a cast iron pot and some coals. Participants make everything from persimmon pudding to chicken tortilla soup. I hung out with some folks who were having a mini family reunion that day at the competition.
So I wanted to reveal your unfair advantage of candy.
Jonathan Brandt is slinging some good-natured trash talk at another cook, Billy Gilmore.
Candies are just there for show, for looks. They don't have anything to do with our recipe.
Billy's recipe is called an untraditional caramel apple cobbler. Back over at their picnic table, Jonathan's wife Mindy is chopping kale and carrots for the stew.
I think it has a lot of flavor. It's hard to make a soup that has flavor the day you make it. Usually they taste better later, but this one tastes good, I think, the day of, so.
Mindy and Jonathan have been participating in the cook-off since the very beginning. They're old pros. Mindy, this year, convinced her sister to also enter the competition.
I asked about an electric mixer if I could plug one in, and she said no. We're doing it from scratch like our relatives did.
Sue Nelson. She's putting the ingredients together for a peach upside-down cake. So, Dutch ovens. These are cast iron pots. You can cook with them over a fire, but today our cooks are putting them in two metal pans and using hot coals instead. These pots have legs, so you can put coals underneath, and the lid has a lip, so you can place coals on top as well. The idea is you get a consistent heat, so you can put the food in the Dutch oven, go on a nice long hike, and when you get back, boom, there's dinner. Jonathan has been cooking with a Dutch oven since his sons were in Boy Scouts, so he's helping Sue and her husband Bob get their dessert cooking.
For this peach dessert dish, there will be 6 coals below, and what did you say, Sue? 18 will be on top, and it creates a real even heat, especially for something that's going to be like an upside-down cake where you really want to make sure it cooks all the way through. There you go. Ready?
Then we're to do 45 minutes. And we're to turn it regularly so that the coals don't burn the bottom. Doesn't seem like enough charcoal to me, but I'm not going to worry about it right now.
Well, we'll wait and see until we get done here whether we have cake or soup.
It's amazing how much heat these Dutch ovens hold inside, even with just 18 coals. Sue Nelson has plucked the coals off the lid to see how her peach upside-down cake is doing.
It looks better than I thought it would be.
So this crazy Dutch oven thing worked out?
Yes, it baked quicker than, about 10 minutes quicker, too. So I used my toothpick to check and make sure it was done.
So you're holding your ready-to-be-judged sign. You're clutching it. You are ready. Are you nervous?
No. I don't care if I win or not. It's been fun to be with all these people.
Sue's dish did not win an award, neither did Jonathan and Mindy's turkey soup, but they didn't mind. Listen to a longer version of that story from Patoka Lake at eartheats.org. A fine group of people for Earth Eats, including Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Kate Griebel, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepherd, Kale Wilk, and everyone at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Thanks for listening today, and a special thanks to everyone who chipped in a couple bucks to support everything we do here at Earth Eats. You're the best. See you in a week. I'm Annie Corrigan.